Apologies to you for the fact that the rector is not here tonight. If, like me, you were expecting him to be speaking, I understand your sense of letdown. Seriously, he does send his apologies that he's not able to be here this evening. We haven't abandoned Hebrews either. He'll be back next week, and we will finish off Hebrews 12 then. But it seemed good to us, in the light of that challenging talk from Michael Griffiths last week, that those who hadn't already packed their bags for foreign parts, that we should just spend this evening looking at a question something along these lines. How do I actually know if I am called? If I am called to missionary service or to any other kind of job than what I'm in at the moment? I can remember some 13 years ago at an evening service which was a lot smaller than this, Dick interviewing a missionary. We were all, you know, that time when we all face round to whichever direction that way is. And he was talking to her. She was a scintillating personality. She got the most remarkable story. God had obviously been working wonderfully out there. And we all left thrilled, gripped, excited. She was attractive too. So we were all sure that we were called to go. If you'd interviewed us at the end of the evening, we would have all been saying, missionary, that's for us. I mean, particularly when the alternative was Monday morning teaching 2A6 at Highbury Grove, you can understand the attractions. But if you come back to me next Sunday and said, well, are you really called, Hugh? I'd be saying, well, I'm not quite sure. How do I know? And I think that's the sort of issue we want to tackle tonight. Dick said to me as we were talking about it, he said, I'm very happy if 400 people go. He seems quite happy to start Sunday evenings all over again. I'm very happy if 400 people are called to go. He said, I'd be very unhappy if one person went who wasn't genuinely sent of God. It's not a light step. So let's try and work it out. I'm not therefore intending to be negative tonight. The point of tonight is not to say don't go. It's actually to say let's find out where God really wants us to be. And it's going to involve us, I'm afraid, in a little bit of a paper chase. So do sort of warm your finger muscles up and take the tracksuits off or whatever you need to do. But I was trying to think, you see, the apostle's letter, which tells us all about guidance in one easy letter, hasn't yet been discovered. They didn't write their letters just to tell us about how we get guided. If you try and work out where are we going to look, it's clear that the Gospels aren't really going to give us an enormous amount of help. How did people get guided in the Gospels? Jesus came up to them and said, follow me, follow me. If we look at those stories, I'm still left asking the question I had at the beginning. How do I know when Jesus is saying to me, follow me? He doesn't appear physically today. So to know how Christians are normally moved around by God, I've got to look after the ascension, haven't I? That's where I'm going to get my answer. How does God move people around? I'm assuming that here we are, we're converted, we're consecrated, we're ready to go. Well, will you just start with the reading we had, 1 Corinthians 7. We'll get a few clues here that may do a little bit of groundwork for us. Only let everyone, says Paul to these Corinthians, let everyone lead the life which the Lord has assigned to him. That's what we're after, isn't it? Wanting to lead the life which the Lord has assigned to us. And in which God has called him. Now, as you look at those verses, I wonder what went through your mind when you saw that word called, what you thought he was talking about. It may be a little ambiguous if you just look at verse 17. So look at when it comes again, verse 18. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Or verse 21, were you a slave when called? The more you look at the verses, the more clear it becomes, doesn't it? That when Paul talks about us being called, he's actually talking about the great calling that we all have as Christians. We're called to Christ. We're called to be a Christian. That's what it means here. And the problem that he's actually dealing with is, yes, this is what we have to do, verse 17. We're Christians. Now, how do we lead the life which the Lord has assigned to us, in which God has called us? That's his starting point to these Corinthian Christians. They've got to learn to live life properly as Christians. The context in the preceding verses is one of marriage. Here they all are, and a number of them find that though they've been converted, their partners have not. And I, as far as I can see, what's been going through their minds, say this: if I'm going to be a really flat-out zealous Christian, then I better divorce this one and find someone who is a Christian. And Paul says, no. No, he says, you don't put someone away just like that. Now, if they're insisting on going, that's a different matter. But you can actually live as a real Christian, even in a mixed marriage situation. Mixed in the sense that one is a believer and the other is not. Now, please, let's put in this word of warning. He's writing to the situation where people were already married before they were converted. If you're wondering about getting married in a situation which will lead to a mixed marriage, one a believer, one not, Paul has got some other words for you. He has a one-word piece of guidance for that, and it's simply don't. But here he says, no, is this the situation you find yourself when you're called, when you were converted? Well, your task is to live as a Christian in that situation. It's amazing what other things he applies it to. He quickly moves on from marriage to circumcision, showing just how unimportant circumcision or uncircumcision is. And then you find that remarkable verse 21. Did you notice it? Were you a slave when called? Never mind. Stunning. Now, what he's saying is not that he's got absolutely no sympathies for the conditions of slaves. We'll discover he's plenty of that. What he's saying is, don't think that rules you out. Well, how can I be a slave and a Christian? I mean, you know, it's not much of a Christian job, is it? Here he is, writing a little later on. This is to the Ephesians. He writes, slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters, with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart, as to Christ, not in the way of eye service, as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will, as to the Lord and not to men. Slaves, lead the life assigned to you. You could be a slave and still living as a real Christian, doing absolute valuable service for God. You can be a slave and in the Lord's service. Now, do you begin to see what that truth does for so much of our talk? It means the end of talking about vocations in the limited, narrow way we so often do, as if only people who are doctors or soldiers or clergymen are in vocations. No, lawyers as well, sorry. Surely, if a slave can be involved in the Lord's service, so can the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, whatever our job, would it be in the Lord's service? It's the end of talking about vocations in a limited way. Don't let's get too high-flown ideas about particular jobs. It's the start of all the hassles people have. Have you noticed it? Whenever they try to give out a notice and talk about full-time workers, it's okay when they write it because they can put inverted commas in. But have you not noticed that they start off and they say, oh, there's a meeting for all full-time workers. And they catch Michael on the front row there frowning viciously because he's wanting to say that although he's working for British Telecom occasionally, he is a full-time worker too. And so the chap tries to dig himself out of the pit. No, he says, I mean all those who are in the ministry, and Michael is still looking daggers, all those who are in the ministry full-time, he says. finds he's just said the same thing as he started with, and who are paid for it. Well, I wish I knew what the easy form of words was that does it, but do you not recognize the problem? Isn't it good we've got that problem? Doesn't it actually mean we begin to understand this truth that I can be in the Lord's service? Whatever my form of job may be. Well, I've got to realize, I've got to work out how to define those who are set apart for other things. But what I'm wanting to say is that when we come to consider, should I be an accountant, a doctor, or a missionary? I'm not talking about some magic calling. I'm actually in the realm of guidance, aren't I? Which is the life that's been assigned to me? I've not got some on some enormous plateau and others on another. And how does God move me around? And one of the factors will simply be this: circumstances. It seems to me it's what's being said here. Actually, what's more frightening, no, maybe more encouraging, is to say it's not only circumstances, but God has often, long before we were a Christian, used them. Isn't that the gist of it? Where were you when you were called? Where were you when you were converted? Well, in terms of the conditions he's talking here, and I realize he's not talking just about jobs, except for the slave and the freeman, he says that's where you better start. Stay where you are. It's a good starting point. We're always anxious to change. It's understandable. We get enthusiastic. Other jobs sound so much more exciting than ours. But why did God put you where you are? In studying for 5 years to be a doctor, why switch? You're working as an accountant. Why move? What's God doing for you there? God's at work long before he converted you. You've only got to look at the life of Paul to see that, haven't you? I mean, if really he was going to have one person who could hold the Gentile and Jewish church together, surely it's got to be someone with a background like Paul, who can go to the Gentiles and knows every move the Jewish church will make to break it up. Why? Because he was so immersed in their background himself. If you're going to have someone who can debate and argue as Paul was going to do to do his evangelistic ministry, what better training could he have had than what he'd had long before he was converted? When I was converted at college, I was reading law. And in the first flush of enthusiasm, I decided, as some people do, it didn't have quite such a dirty name in those days, that I didn't want to do law anymore, which was rather a tedious, boring subject. I was going to read theology. It's time I got to know my Bible better. You may raise your eyebrows at that. But in my enthusiasm to go to theology, I found in the end that I wasn't bright enough for them to let me switch. And I couldn't understand why. I'd worked out I wasn't going to practice law. I never did practice it. I didn't really understand why I was meant to be doing law at the time. I did go on eventually to read theology, and it was only when I got there that I understood why God had kept me where he'd called me to begin with. I needed those extra 2 years, firstly to establish myself as a Christian, if I was going to stand any chance in theology, and secondly, I needed those 2 years of law to learn to think in a way that would help me to grapple with the issues in theology. Why has God brought you to where you are now? He'll have done it for a purpose. There's a telling example at the end of Mark chapter 5, the story of Legion. Don't look it up now, but you'll remember Legion is remarkably converted and transformed, and as Jesus is sent packing because they didn't like what happened to their pigs, Legion comes up to him and says, "Jesus, can I go with you?" He begs to be part of the traveling band. Who wouldn't? There's something very attractive about it, isn't it? And Jesus turns him down. He says, "No, you can't come with me. Sorry. You've got to go back where you are. You bear your witness to me where you are." Now, looking back, you can understand why Jesus did that, can't you? I mean, if he moved out of home territory, who would he have been? Just another speaker. Traveling around the towns there, who was he? Why, he was the mad demoniac, who's now so completely different. Which is why we're told at the end of the story, he went away, he began to proclaim in the 10 towns around how much Jesus had done for him, and all men marveled. J.C. Ryle comments on it in his little thoughts on Mark's Gospel, and he just warns us about moving unadvisedly and too quickly from whatever our secular calling is to enter the ministry of the Gospel. He says, in plain words, I doubt whether men who've been suddenly converted to God in the army, the navy, the law, or the merchant's office do not sometimes forsake their professions with undue haste in order to become clergymen. It seems to be forgotten that conversion alone is no proof that we're called and qualified to become teachers of others. God may be glorified as really and truly in the secular calling as in the pulpit. Converted men can be eminently useful as landlords, magistrates, soldiers, sailors, barristers, or merchants. We want witnesses for Christ in all these professions. Circumstances is one of the ways that God uses to put us where he wants us, and circumstances in our past. Oh, but also he uses them to move us, doesn't he? He's hinted at that in these verses. Were you a slave when called? Verse 21, never mind. But if you can gain your freedom, or if the opportunity does arise, if they let you buy your way out or whatever was going to come up, then avail yourself of the opportunity. Being a slave is no barrier to being a Christian and to serving Christ. But he realizes it's no great shakes. If the circumstances come, take them. You become free. It's a nice little warning to us as well, isn't it, that gift horses aren't necessarily wrong. You can be a missionary in the Bahamas, as a friend of mine was. It puts a whole new light on missionary work, doesn't it? If there's something you've been longing to do all your life, and suddenly God opens up the possibilities for it, and for all other reasons it seems right, don't feel that because it looks so nice, God can't possibly want it for you. We can get into that sort of masochistic frame of mind. God used circumstances, didn't he, to move Paul to Rome. Oh, we know Paul wanted to get there, but I don't think he'd have chosen that route, would he? As a prisoner? And God is just moving him. We need to learn to be content, as Paul was, with the way God chooses, and make the most of it. Where are your circumstances leading you? Of course, circumstances by themselves aren't enough, or we'd all go in all sorts of directions. Here's another question that seems to spring from the New Testament, the way God moves us around. What are your convictions? Are you convinced about a change? We find more than once in the Acts that the apostles say, it seemed right to us. You know what it's like to have some inner conviction. Yes, that's the way we seem to be settled. Or look on a few pages, will you, to 1 Timothy? Page 195. 1 Timothy chapter 3. And verse 1. The saying is sure. If anyone aspires to the office of bishop, he desires a noble task. Bishop isn't quite the same as the way we use the word these days. But the point is this, surely. Do you see what he's saying? If anyone aspires to it, that's a good thing. No one's there's nothing against aspiration, against ambition. Against, yes, that is my settled desire. Great, says Paul, if that's the way you're aspiring, you're aiming. How do I know if it's a God-given aspiration? Well, the test of things very often is time, isn't it? I mean, a fortnight after that interview with the missionary, I'd found something else that I was sure that I was meant to be doing instead of teaching 2A6. This is exam term. The other side of exams, if you're still convinced missionary work is for you, that may be a very strong pointer that God is really speaking. When I get great ideas, don't you often find you're struggling to work out, is this a Hugh Palmer idea or is it a brainwave? The two are incompatible. Is it just me dreaming something up, or is it actually a thought implanted by God? I mustn't assume it's one or the other straight away. There's nothing wrong with conviction, but on its own, it's not enough. On its own, it means we all go in the end where we want to, because we're very good at having our own selfish convictions. If anyone aspires to the office of bishop, he desires a noble task. That's great. Good that you have those ambitions. I'm afraid it's not enough, because the question's going to go on and say, are you up to it? You've got the right character, above reproach, husband of one wife, temperate, sensible, dignified, hospitable. Just as important, are you gifted for it? You see that word, that little phrase in verse 2? An apt teacher. Marvellous that you aspire to it, but I'm afraid it's no good just having verse 1 without verse 2. Paul is warning Timothy, don't appoint them just because they're convinced they're meant to be bishops. Circumstances, conviction, and there's our third factor, gift. What's your gift? Are you gifted for the area you feel called to, convinced is to be yours? You see, that seems the pattern by which God works. Back a few pages now to Ephesians chapter 4. Page 182. Here's Paul writing about Christ's church, and he's writing about the ascended Christ, and we come to verse 11, and we discover that the ascended Christ gives gifts, and his gifts were that some should be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers. Do notice, it's not that everyone should be apostles or everyone prophets. It's not even that all those different gifts in verse 11 are what everyone is. We're all one or the other of them. No, of course not. We still need plenty of us left over to be the saints of verse 12 who need to be equipped for the ministry, the work of ministry. But do you see the way Christ seems to be working in his church? He's given gifts to some to do their tasks. So I say, yes, I'm to be a missionary. Have you got the gift for it? What do you say? Well, what gift do I need? Well, that's a good place to start looking, isn't it? I think God may be wanting me to be a minister. Have you got the gift for it? Well, what gift do I need? It's a good place to start looking, isn't it? What is the it? And how do I tell if I've got it? I want to suggest that, unspiritual though it may sound, one of the best ways of telling if we've got it is trial and error. Now, trial and error, this end, not the other end, not going off as a missionary and then trying. Do you believe you're called to some work? Well, let's try it out. I can remember a couple of people in Norwich coming to me convinced that they ought to be involved in youth work. My judgment is appalling. It was even worse then. So I didn't dare say no outright. And in the end, I hit upon this idea. I simply said, Marvis, come along to the youth group next Friday and see how you get on. And then we'll talk about it. I come along for a few Fridays. They both came along for one Friday each. Quickly discovered, wasn't their scene. Didn't have the gift for it. No harm done. How else were they going to discover if they got on with youth? They would never take it from me. I remember talking as I was leaving theological college with a member of a missionary society and asking about what sort of people they wanted to go overseas. And he realized that I was asking one of these lovely questions about, all nice in the abstract, which was really another way of saying, did they want me? But I was too chicken to actually put it as bluntly as that. And this chap was shrewd enough, and he just looked at me and he said, go and get some experience first. We want people who are proven out there. Let's see that you have a ministry, and then we'll see where God may be able to use you. Are you gifted for it? Well, of course, the fact that I've got a gift isn't enough on its own, is it? I mean, I think I've got a gift. Others may not. What do others say? Have I been chosen? What are my circumstances? Am I convinced? Am I gifted? What do others say? I was looking in the articles at the back of the prayer book. Seem to have had a lot of articles recently. I don't know what's going wrong. But here's one that makes this point very, very neatly. Article 23, listen to this. It's very shrewd about guidance and gifts. It's not lawful for any man to take upon him the office of public preaching or ministering the sacraments in the congregation before he be lawfully called and sent to execute the same. Well, that's all right, but how do I get called? Those we ought to judge lawfully called and sent, which be chosen and called to this work by men who have public authority given unto them in the congregation to call and send ministers into the Lord's vineyard. Now, it may not always work out in practice, but isn't that a marvelous safeguard? I don't just appear in the pulpit because I say, look, I've got a gift to teach, folks, so you better listen to me. I'm God's gift to this. I'm God's gift to that. No. I'll go off all over the place if deciding my gifts can be done by me. What's the church got to say about it? A friend of mine went to a missionary society, one of their selection conferences, and he was asked by one of the selectors, tell me, why do you think you're called to missionary work? And he simply looked up at him and said, I have no idea at all. I've come here for you to tell me if I am or not. He was putting it bluntly. But it wasn't totally opposed to the way the New Testament went about it. Time and again, it's the church that made decisions. They decided to send Barnabas and Paul. They decided who would be the leaders. Look back again, page 200, Titus. We're doing well, nearing the end. Titus chapter 1, verse 5. Dear Titus becomes a kind of bishop of Crete. How did he get the job? Well, here's Paul writing, this is why I left you in Crete. He was appointed by Paul. What was he appointed to do? That you might amend what was defective and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. Oh, along the lines that we've already half looked at before, that they have the right gift, the right aptitude for the job. But Titus, you appoint them. They don't appoint themselves. There's a marvelous cutting line in the Proverbs, which is worth bearing in mind when we're considering any item of guidance. Here's what the writer writes. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. What does the church say? I have got this brainwave, and I'm convinced now that it's absolutely right. It may be just an idea to put into practice. It may be a new job for me. Why don't I ask others about it? I know why in my own heart. It's because I'm afraid some of them might say no, and I rather like it. I'm afraid that they might be wiser than I am and show me the shortcomings in my ideas. And it is such a good one in my mind. The way of a fool is always right in his own eyes. The wise man seeks advice, and seeks it from those who won't see us through rose-tinted spectacles. Do learn to have at least one friend who can say no to you, or the advice isn't worth getting. It means, for those of us who are younger, says he, trying to keep youth. It means that our parents may well be among those we consider. What advice have they got? They know us best. Parents are an awful lot shrewder than we dare to admit. Remember when I was first seriously thinking about getting ordained, and of course I didn't bother to tell my parents anything about those thoughts at that time, for fear of what they might think. But as I got more and more serious, I decided before finally I got everything cut and dried, actually it would be right and wise to talk to them about it. And then I thought, how do I get round to the subject? And I was driving my mum up to Yorkshire one day. We lived just south of London, and we hadn't got very far, and I remember trying to think, how on earth do I bring this subject round to this? And I couldn't work out how to do it, and we'd just come over Richmond Bridge, and I prayed one of those silly prayers that people like me pray sometimes. I said, Lord, I'll give you till we get to the A1 to bring the subject up. And if you haven't done it before then I'll bat straight in. I'm not recommending that as a prayer. Doesn't apply very often. But I prayed that prayer, and there was a sort of 30-second silence after whatever we'd said before, and we just got to the roundabout at Richmond, and we're going to head up to Kew. And my mum said, Hugh, I was talking with your dad the other day, and I was just saying to him, I wouldn't be surprised if you don't become a clergyman one day. And I don't tell the story just because it's a remarkable answer to prayer, but really because for me, the fact that my parents were in sympathy and saw that it was right was a confirmation of all the other pointers that I'd had, that was where God was wanting to move me. But of course, what the church says, what others say, isn't enough on its own. Though we do need to listen to it. And we do perhaps particularly need to listen in the day when maybe few of us will be in totally pioneer missionary situations as to whether the church wants us or not. Look at one last example, and this may be a little too peculiar. Forgive me if you think it is. But I think it has a lesson for us. Back in Acts chapter 16, page 1-8. Here's Paul. He's been visiting the places he'd been to on his previous missionary journey. He got Silas with him. And verse 9, they're just working out where they're going to go next. A vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia was standing, beseeching him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. And when he'd seen the vision, immediately we sought to go on into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. I find it very telling. Do the people in Macedonia want us? For Paul, one of the reasons for, and do notice that phrase in verse 10, it was concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. Well, that was what he could work out. One of the reasons for it was that he seemed to be understanding the people in Macedonia needed him. We seem to live in an age where people set up Christian missions left, right and centre, where there are stacks of Christians working at the moment, and we all decide that our own particular unique mission is bound to be the one that does it. And we found that even in good old England, out in Norwich, people were setting up churches left, right and centre. They were doing work that they assumed no one else was doing. It did seem an awful waste of manpower. One wondered if they'd ever consulted with anyone, with any of the Christians around, as to whether there was need for help or how it might best be. Surely it's wise to know if we're wanted somewhere else. We are in all sorts of parts of the world. The UCCF handbook lists endless vacancies. Missionary societies know who's wanted and what sort of person. If we're not wanted, we certainly need to think hard before we go. Oh, and even if we are, by the way, and even if the conclusion that Paul got to is right, it may not be that pleasant. Do notice that 10 verses later he's in jail. It's not necessarily an easy ride. What are your circumstances? Where do they point you? Well, are you convinced about it? What are your convictions? Where do they point you? What are your gifts? Where do they point you? What does the church say? What do others say? Where does that point you? And someone says, I noticed that you kept on talking about each of those things not being enough on their own. So actually, what do I do if I've got a few of those? Well, that's just the point, isn't it? It's as things come in line that we get surer and surer. I can't have magic. I can't lose my responsibility. I long to let someone else make my mind up for me. Now, just because Gareth says, you'd be brilliant in that job, doesn't mean to say that God's saying it. Gareth's occasionally wrong. There isn't a verse in the Bible that says go to Thailand or go to Tooting. And when we spend all our quiet times, you know, praying that the passage we're reading today will tell me which house job to take, the one thing I can guarantee you is that you won't understand the passage you're reading. I'm afraid God doesn't move us around on magic hunch. He's made us human beings. We'll have to do what Paul and Silas did and conclude that this is where God wants us, from all that he's shown us so far. At the end of the day, we do have to, if I can put it reverently, go with what we've got. And trust in the God who guides. You see, if we've understood the nature of God, we'll realize that basically it's actually his problem rather than ours. Will you turn to one last verse? It's back in the Old Testament. It's Psalm 32. Page 489, the Old Testament sections. I will instruct you and teach you the way you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. It's God's job to get through to us and to teach us and to instruct us and to counsel us where he wants to move us, if he wants to move us. And your and my job? Well, that's verse 9. Be not like a horse or a mule without understanding, which must be curbed with bit and bridle, else it will not keep with you. Don't be an ass. Don't take leave of your senses. Just keep alert to what God is teaching you. What's he teaching you through your circumstances? What's he teaching you through your conviction? What's he teaching you through the gifts you're discovering you've got? What's he teaching you through what others say? Are they beginning to line up in a direction? Well, then go for it. He'll guide. He's perfectly capable of shutting the door if it's wrong. He's perfectly capable of opening the door if it's right. Relax. We have to lead the life the Lord has assigned to us. Most of our problems come because we want to assign our own lives to ourselves. Let's pray. I will instruct you. I will teach you. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. Our gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for the promise you give us. And we pray that we might be those who would have understanding and would be willing to move where you move us and to stay where you want us to remain. Grant us that, we pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen.